Okay, so we are in Perek Vav, in chapter 6, and talking about the question of why the parade matters. Why do we care so much about Mordechai getting paraded around the city? After all, it's not the moment that turns everything around in the sense of ending Haman's campaign. Haman is only going to get killed because of what he does, what Esther does, really, in chapter 7. And then, and even that isn't going to stop the attack on the Jews. So why does Mordechai's parade matter? Especially when, as we outline the structure in the Megillah, the pairs of things, the rise and fall of Haman, and so on, it looks like the parade is somehow considered to be a pivotal point. So so what we did was to identify two thematic perspectives, two themes that you can identify here in this chapter, not mutually exclusive. And the first is the idea of divine manipulation, seeing the Megillah as a demonstration of God manipulating things. And what we showed last time was that you could actually see that in the story about this parade, how God is moving things, starting with the disturbance of Paro of Achashverosh's sleep, and then continuing in the reading of the chronicles of the king, the Divrei Hayamim, where it's read in a passive voice. It was found to be recorded, statements that made it look like there's an outside manipulator of events. And that's one way that you can look at this story here in this chapter, is it's divine manipulation that makes it happen. And what we're going to do now is show that there's another way to read the story, in which the story is simply an illustration of what Esther had done. It's it's how Esther's plot is what moves Achashverosh to be more suspicious of Haman, and so on. And once we've seen the two different views, one, that this is a product of divine manipulation, and two, that it's a product of Esther's work, then we're going to move ahead and show how you could actually look at this story as pivotal and meaningful for the message of the entire book. And you'll see as this plays out. I realize that the framing of it is a little vague still, but you'll see what I mean as we go through it. So again, we have already seen this story as a product of a divine hand. Let's look at it now in terms of Esther's hand. So I brought you on your source sheet, first in source number one, I brought what I've had from last week, the pieces that show that it's divine manipulation. It's a response to the fasts of the people. Achashverosh's sleep is disturbed, and the passive voice in the reading aloud of the chronicles. But now let's move it to the second source here, in Esther's manipulation. Back in chapter 5, Esther moved Achashverosh and Haman into place. Right? She invites Achashverosh and Haman to her first party, at which she says, I'd like there to be a second party. Well, Achashverosh's actions in chapter 6 could be read as demonstrating that what Esther did in chapter 5 was very effective. First of all, because he can't sleep, and he brings out his Sefer HaZichronot, the Book of Chronicles. And that may be understood, as we said last week, as God disturbing his sleep, but it may be understood as Esther being very effective. If you take a look at source number 3, the Gemara in Megillah, which we saw last week, giving one explanation for why Achashverosh can't sleep. It's the sleep of the king of the universe that is disturbed, and so on. So as you continue in source number 3, look at what Rava says. The sage Rava. So if you're following in the Hebrew, you want the third line. And if you're following in the English, you want the second paragraph in source number 3. Rava Omar, Shnas HaMelech Achashverosh Mamash. It was actually Achashverosh's sleep. It's not God's sleep. It's not the angels. Achashverosh himself can't sleep. Why? Nafla le milsa bedaite. Because he had a thought. Omar, he said, Maidikaman desaminte Esther Lahaman. What is this that Esther is inviting Haman to the party? Where did that come from, that Esther should be inviting Haman to this party? Dilma Eitza Kashakle Ilave Dehahu Gavra Lemikdale. Maybe this is a plot to kill me. When he uses the term that man, it's the royal third person. But maybe this is a plot. There's some kind of a plot between Esther and Haman. Hadar Amar, and then he said, Ihachi, if so, Lo Ava Gavra Derachimli Dahava Modali. Isn't there anyone who's on my side who would tell me about this plot? There's no one who would inform me. So then he says, well, maybe no one found out about the plot. No, I'm sorry. Someone found out about the plot, but decided it's not worth it to tell me. Hadar Amar, he then said, Dilma Ika Inish Da'avad Bitivusa Velo Parate. Maybe there's somebody who has done something good for me. I never paid him back. Mishum Hachi Mimne Yinshi Velo Maguli. So people realize it doesn't pay for them to be a snitch. Right? They're only gonna tell me if they think there's something in it for them. Miyad Vayomer Laviyah Sefer Zichronos Divrei HaYomim. And so he says, bring out the chronicles. I want to know what's going on. And then, of course, he is agitated because he hears that he did not reward Mordechai. And therefore, he says, who is out in the yard? Right? And then you get that whole setup of Haman. Right? Where he says, who is it who... what should I do for somebody who I want to honor? And he words it so vaguely. He doesn't say, there's this guy Mordechai who I want to honor. Why doesn't he tell Haman who he wants to honor? Why doesn't he say right in the beginning, I want to honor Mordechai? Yeah, Susan?
I think he doesn't, because he's already said he doesn't trust Haman. So if he tells Haman that it's not him, Haman might not give him an honest answer.
I would actually take that further. Remember, Ahasuerus at this stage in the Megillah doesn't know that there's anything between Haman and Mordechai. Haman has never said it. We know as the reader. Haman has never said anything. Haman is there that day in order to tell Ahasuerus that he has something against Mordechai. Ahasuerus is hiding Mordechai's identity not so much in order to keep Mordechai a secret as to keep Haman thinking that it's him. He's luring Haman into a trap, knowing full well Haman is going to think that this is about him. That's where he goes with it. That's a straight read of the story. Malbim, though, characteristically, says there's more here. In order to appreciate Malbim's comments on this section, you have to remember something we said back in chapter 3. Do you remember we asked why Ahasuerus elevated Haman to make him the second in command? And we had one explanation, that it was because Ahasuerus feels very insecure, and so he wants somebody who is beholden to him, and he takes somebody who's outside the power structure and puts him in charge. And that was one explanation. Another explanation, though, was that he wanted to reward whoever it was who trapped Bigtan and Teresh. Meaning, the very end of chapter 2, he found out Bigtan and Teresh are plotting against his life, right? That was the end of chapter 2. Now he says, I want to reward whoever notified me, so I'm going to elevate them. But remember, the news came from Esther to Ahasuerus. Esther said, Mordechai told me. But Ahasuerus has forgotten that it was Mordechai who told them, who told her that. He just knows it came from Esther. So he wants Esther to feel good. So he elevates Haman because, as the Malbim understands it, Haman is Mihuman, who was the one who said to have the women brought before the king in the first place. So therefore, he gave Haman, as a way to satisfy Esther, as a way to make Esther happy, he gave Haman a position of power. Esther sees Haman as an ally, right? That's the idea. Esther sees Haman as a supporter, and therefore I'm going to make Esther happy by elevating Haman. That was all Malbim's idea back in chapter 3. Okay, we've got a little review in there. Well, with that in mind, now that he's heard this story, now that Ahasuerus has heard that Mordechai was the one who had ratted out Bigtan and Teresh. Mordechai was the one who saved the life of the king. So Ahasuerus is thinking to himself, wait a minute. Haman received the honor that was due to Mordechai. I rewarded Haman for catching Bigtan and Teresh, but Haman's the wrong guy. Mordechai is the one I should have rewarded. So keep that in mind as you take a look at source number 4 on your sheet from the Malbim. And I'm going to read it in my English translation to make it simpler because it's a little dense. Ahasuerus knew that Haman would incorrectly think that his words were about him. Okay? Ahasuerus knows, just like every reader of the Megillah knows, that Haman is listening to those words and thinking, oh yeah, that's me he wants to honor. Ahasuerus wanted that the honor Haman sought for himself, he should do for Mordechai. Since, in truth, the honor should not go to Haman, but to Mordechai. He's now correcting the wrong from the beginning of chapter 3. And now you get to what Malbim does with words. You gotta love Malbim with words. He is so sensitive to the language in the Megillah. But you know what? Rather than show it to you in the text of Malbim, we're gonna see it in the text of the Megillah itself. That's a smarter way for us to do this. So take a look, please, at chapter 6. Okay? Take a look at chapter 6 and at the wording that Ahasuerus uses with Haman in sentence 3. This is before he speaks to Haman. This is when Ahasuerus hears that Mordechai saved him. Okay? Ahasuerus just heard that Mordechai saved him from Bigtan and Teresh. In sentence 3, what does the king say should be done for Mordechai that wasn't done?
He should be rewarded.
He should be rewarded. What words in the Hebrew?
Yekar
ugdula. Yekar is honor. You will often find Aramaic that will translate kavod as yakar. Literally, what does the word yakar mean besides honor?
Precious.
Not precious.
Precious.
Nope.
No?
What does the word kavod mean?
Dear. Well, yakar means dear to you, doesn't it?
It often does, but it all comes from a particular
word. Kavod from kaved.
Bingo. Dahlia knows. Kavod is from kaved, to be heavy, and yakar is also something that is heavy. Okay? That's where it comes from. So, something heavy, something of status, yakar. Gidula is greatness. So, in chapter 6, sentence 3, Ahasuerus says, Mordechai should have gotten yakar ugdula. Now, he has Haman in front of him in sentence 6. Ahasuerus says to Haman, what should we be doing for the man, Asher Hamelech Chafetz Bikaro. The man for whom the king wants to give Yakar. What word did he drop?
Gidula.
He skipped the word Gidula. So the Malbim says, that's not an accident. That's not just clumsy wording. That's on purpose. Take a look at source number 4 now, back in the Malbim. The third line in the English there, therefore, or in the Hebrew, mitamze, therefore he did not ask Haman what he should do for the one whom the king would want to give yakar and gidula, for then Haman would have known the king wasn't thinking about him. He had already reached the height of gidula, right? Back in chapter 3, sentence 1, gidal hamelech Ahasuerus et Haman. Haman already has gidula. If the king says, I want to give someone gidula, Haman will know, that's not me. There is no such thing as gidula for me. I'm already up there. Ahasuerus already gave him all the gidula you could give him. He's already as great as he can be. Therefore, Ahasuerus traps Haman using only the word yakar. Fascinating. He's trying to give Mordechai the honor that Haman should have, that Haman wanted for himself. One other note, which is tangential, but it's always funny to me, and so therefore I'm going to bring it. If you take a look at what Haman says should be brought for the king, okay, so take a look at sentence 8. What does Haman think should be brought for the king?
Horse.
The horse. Right? Levush Malchut, royal garb.
Right.
Right? And the horse. And what else?
Royal crown. Crown, the Keter.
The crown. Does he want the crown to be brought also?
Oh, he doesn't say it.
I'll tell you why I ask. In sentence 9, he just says, let the clothing and the horse be given to one of the officers and so on. And in sentence 10, the king says to Haman, take the clothing and take the horse. The crown disappears. So there are different midrashim to explain this. But here's my favorite thought. It's not from a midrash. Ibn Ezra makes the suggestion in source number 6 on your sheet. Tell me something. Before we read it in Ibn Ezra, how would you read, how would you translate that line where he mentioned the crown? Starting from the horse in sentence 8. Sorry?
It's unclear. There was so, whose head?
Bidiuk. Chana picks it. You could read this as the crown goes on the king's head or the rider's head, or the crown goes on the horse's head. I kid you not. Take a look at Ibn Ezra. V'hanachon be'enai, in source number 6, it appears right in my eyes, shevav birosho, the vav, the him, when it says his head, shaval hasus, is talking about the horse. Ki yesh sus shalmelech, sheyasimu keter machut birosho, kasher yirkav alav hamelech, because they have a special horse, and when the king rides the horse, they put the king's crown on the horse's head. That's what they do. So the crown goes on the horse's head. So in other words, it's not that he's saying bring the crown. Bring the horse that wears the crown when the king is riding that horse. That's the idea. It's sort of like in the U.S., you know, the president has a plane called Air Force One. But it's only called Air Force One when the president is on the plane. Otherwise, it loses that tag. It's not identified as Air Force One. So this horse is only called the horse, you know, the king's horse, when the crown is on its head because the king is riding the horse. That's the idea. Yes, Susan.
If we take the divine interpretation and we look at Moby, it won't work because if there was divine intervention, at least the way I read it, then why didn't Hashem intervene right there and get more? The whole story would have not been able to happen. The Jews would not have been in trouble had the king honored Mordechai at the time, realized it was Mordechai, and raised Mordechai instead of Haman to that position for saving his life.
So, it's an interesting question. I would offer two answers. Number one, you could blend the two approaches and suggest that God intervenes to the extent necessary, but leaves room for human beings like Esther to move things along. So God is going to do certain things, but not others. You could suggest that. But I don't even know that you need that, because I have a second approach here, which is, if Achashverosh knows about Mordechai from the beginning, it doesn't work to save the Jews. Because
Haman wouldn't have the power.
But you mean originally if Haman had never been elevated?
Yes, because yes. Mordechai would have been elevated. If we take...
Yes. No, then you're right.
Mordechai would have been elevated, not Haman.
Right, no, that's true. That's true.
That's all I'd say.
Yeah. But here I'll point you back to the Gemara that we learned in the beginning, in which we are told that the Jews had done certain things that required improvement and growth, and that's what's supposed to happen through this story.
Okay. Can I remember at the beginning we talked about Mordechai's personality, and some people thought, not Mordechai, Achashverosh, that he was stupid. But as we're learning him, he seems to understand human nature. He understands Haman better than Haman thinks he does. And so he's not stupid. This actually portrays Achashverosh in a different position than we had at the beginning when we outlined his characteristics.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Yes, it makes him look smarter than people may have given him credit for before. But no, because that's a low bar. Like, you're shocked when he reveals some insight into the human personality. You know, I mean, you'd like to think that people normally have this level of insight to know that a guy like Haman is going to think that this is about him. But the answer really, in my mind, is it's very clear in that Gemara, and I said this back when we first had that conversation about Ahasuerus's intellect. Ahasuerus is a schemer. The Gemara's question is he good at it or not? But he's thinking along these lines. This is the way Ahasuerus thinks. Okay, so what we've established here is this. The events of Perek Vav of chapter 6 with Mordechai's parade may be read as God manipulating Ahasuerus' sleep, manipulating what's going to be read for him to lead to a particular conclusion. Or it may be Esther manipulating Ahasuerus through the party so that he can't sleep, and then Ahasuerus suspects Haman and plays out this drama with him. You can read it either way. And now I want to explain, then. Maish, I see your hand. Can you wait a minute? Or 2 minutes? Okay. So what I want to show you is that you have two different ways to view chapter 6, then, in the context of the message of the entire book. If I take the view that Megillat Esther is a story of God intervening to save us in exile, then really this story is the first major divine intervention to help. That's why this is the pivotal story. Because this is the first time you really see divine intervention in order to help us. There is some intervention already in chapter 5 when Esther goes to Ahasuerus, and the text says, "Vatilbash Esther Malchut." She was clothed in, garbed in majesty, and I brought you in source number 7, the Gemara that says it's divine inspiration that is clothing her. So you had some sense of that already back there. But here is when things start moving. Because God disturbs the sleep of Ahasuerus. God makes sure that Ahasuerus hears about Mordechai's loyalty. Which brings us to sentence 13 in chapter 6. Zeresh speaks to her husband. Right? Haman got the advice he wanted the first time round when she said, hey, you should go have Mordechai hanged. He comes back and he wants to have some commiseration, right? He's so upset about about Mordechai still flouting him, and now he's upset about the parade. So take a look at sentence 13 where they say to him, "In mizera ha-Yehudim Mordechai asher hachilosel in polifanav lo suchalo." If Mordechai is from those people from Yehud, right? You're never, ever, ever going to defeat him. It's too late. You started to fall? You're going to continue to fall. Tell me something. When did Zeresh learn that Mordechai was a Yehudi? When did she learn that Mordechai was of these Jews from Yehud?
At least the first time.
In chapter 3. You're right that she knows it in chapter 5, but she knew it back in chapter 3. Everybody knew, because Mordechai can't stop telling them. Ki gid lahem asher hu Yehudi. Mordechai said, hi, I'm from Yehud. So why did she know? It only occurs to her in chapter 6, sentence 13. Where has she been? What's she been doing all along? The answer is, it's not about recognizing that he is from Yehud. It's about recognizing divine favor. That's what she now recognizes. She can understand what Haman doesn't want to see, which is, this is a divine hand, and it will then continue in chapter 7. And I brought it for you here because I didn't want you to wait till we do it in chapter 7, because then no one's going to remember what we did in chapter 6, because that's life. So if you flip to source number 8, the Gemara in Megillah Daf Tet Zayin, Megillah 16a, Ahasuerus is angry when he hears that Haman wants to destroy Esther and her people, and he goes outside to the orchard. And then he comes back in. And he is described as being in quite the rage. Right? Does this ring a bell?
Could you repeat that? You froze in the middle.
Hang on one second. I'm just going to jump networks. Hold on a second, because I'm going to jump networks. I have a bad connection, but I'm going to fix it. Hang on. It'll just take a moment. Okay. Now you hear me better? Hello?
Yeah. Can you repeat, though, what you said?
Yes. So, if you take a look at source number 8, the Gemara in Megillah, it's talking about when Ahasuerus is angry because he just heard that Haman wants to kill Esther and her nation. And the way the text depicts Ahasuerus is that he's livid when he leaves the party to go out to the orchard. And he's livid when he comes back in. Says the Gemara, why didn't he calm down in between? What happened when he was outside? Take a look at source number 8. And the king arose in his anger from the feast of wine to the palace garden, and the king returned from the palace garden to the room of the feast of wine. Just as he rose in anger, so he returned in anger. For he went and found the ministering malachim in the guise of men uprooting the trees of the orchard. He said to them, what are you doing? And they said, oh, Haman instructed us that we should uproot the trees from the orchard. Haman told us that we should do it, presumably in order to get the wood, unless you take the view that it was wood from the Beis HaMikdash, from the temple. But the point is, what the text is trying to do, Moshe, I still see you, what the text is trying to do here, is to build up the argument that this is all divine intervention. And as the text continues, it even suggests Haman is not dumb enough to fall on the bed that Esther is on. On his own, Haman was pushed. A malach pushes him. Because it doesn't say he fell, it says he was falling, meaning a malach comes and knocks him down onto the bed. This is all one way to read the narrative, is that God is moving things step by step by step by step. And the first pivotal moment, although you can make the argument it was when Esther had her Ruach HaKodesh when she went to Ahasuerus the first time, but really the major mover is when he can't sleep. So this story is important because it's the first demonstration of clear divine intervention. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is to say no. Again, this is a story about the Jews acting practically in order to save themselves in exile, in which case, when the text says that Esther went to Ahasuerus bilavush malchut, wearing monarchy, it doesn't mean with divine inspiration. Rather, as Rashi says in source number 9, his first explanation, it means she's wearing royal clothing. This is Esther's effort. And again, if I read this story as being about what human beings do and about what Esther does, this part is also where Esther's party strategy begins to pay off, because the fear disrupts the sleep of Ahasuerus, because Ahasuerus is then moved to trap Haman, because then Mordechai is elevated in the eyes of Ahasuerus and in the eyes of the city. And then Zeresh and crew, instead of saying they perceive divinely, right, that God is on Mordechai's side, they just recognize that now, thanks to Esther, Mordechai is untouchable. And the gallows plan, therefore, has to fail. In which case, go now to the end of chapter 7, not literally, but think about the end of chapter 7. Charvona tells Ahasuerus, Mordechai, who is loyal to you, Haman wants to kill him, right? Classic question, which we're now going to ask, although I was thinking about asking it later, we'll ask it now. How does Charvona know anything about this plot? How is Charvona aware that Haman is planning to hang Mordechai? Haman never had a chance to tell that to anybody.
You told us.
So Malbim, so it depends on which school of thought you take. If I take the view that all of this is playing out at the divine hand, then Charvona is Eliyahu. Right? Charvona is Eliyahu, and he is, Charvona is Eliyahu, and that's how he knows. And he is the one who's gonna destroy Haman. However, if I take the view that this is just practical, it's all happening on a human level, then I take what Susan remembered from last week from the Malbim, which is Charvona was one of the Sarisim. The Sarisim were the ones who showed up to take Haman to the party, and they heard Haman discussing the tree with Zeresh, and that's how Charvona is aware. So you have two ways, you have two levels at which you can read this whole story. Either it's divine intervention, which first pays off with Mordechai on parade, and it's going to matter a great deal because it shows God's hand is now moving against Haman. Or alternatively, this whole story is a product of Esther's movement of Ahasuerus into place, and everything will play out from here. But this story shows Esther's strategy starting to pay off, as she has managed to get into Ahasuerus' head through the parties that she created and the invitation for Haman. Either way, this story is pivotal, not just in the structure of the text, but in terms of showing the strategies start to pay off. Moish, you have been so patient. Go ahead.
No problem. I've got an interesting idea that I've really never ever thought about before or heard anybody think about, and hopefully you will think it interesting. You know, the Gemara looks at the story of Big Tan and Teresh that you talked about. It says, Vayivada Hadavar the Mordechai. And so far as I can remember, the rabbis say, it's Ruach HaKodesh. That's the way the term Vayivada is used. I want to offer you another possibility.
Okay.
I think that Haman was in on the plot. That you have these two guards. They're just soldiers. They can't run the country. They need somebody who's going to run the country with them. And not with them, who they're going to set up to run the country. And it's their discussions with Haman, which bear in mind, okay, they're in the Shar HaMelech. Mordechai's in the Shar HaMelech. Haman's always interested that the people the Shar HaMelech have to bow down to, which suggests that's where he hung out. So it's a good possibility that they discussed this with him, and he left out.
It's a fun Mordechai idea.
Mordechai heard them talking, and he didn't mention Haman as part of the conspiracy. And so the whole story becomes Shakespearean, because Haman thought of himself, I'm going to be riding the crowd. Mordechai's the one riding the crowd. So all this story where you could say that other than the Semitic angle, Haman is dealt with unfairly, he's dealt with totally fairly.
Right.
Because it was his conspiracy.
Moish?
That's it.
Thanks. So three things. Number one is that we do have the other school of thought about how Mordechai found out, the idea that he is versed in all the languages and therefore he is able to hear them and know what's going on.
By the way, a split again
between the two ways to read the narrative. Either Mordechai finds out by divine inspiration, God moving things along, or natural means, it's his own wisdom brought into play. That's number one. Number two, it's a creative idea, the idea, you know, of placing Haman as being involved with them, but him being at the Shar HaMelech is only after he's elevated, not beforehand. But number three, I would never say that this story becomes Shakespearean. It's the opposite. Shakespearean stories are biblical, not biblical stories being Shakespearean. Let's be clear about who came first. So let's highlight one other point here, and this is a point that I think deserves more discussion, but at least I want to plant the seed for it. And that is the perspective of non-Jewish Shushan. We've already seen the debate about how the Jews are perceived, right? We discussed that back in chapter 2, where Rashi and the Malbim thought the Jews are highly respected. In fact, that Esther hides where she comes from, because she's afraid that if they know she's a Jew, then for sure they'll make her queen. Right? That was one school of thought. And then you have the opposite school of thought, Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar, who said, no, the Jews are downtrodden. They're an exile refugee population. And if she's hiding it, she's hiding it because once they know that she's a Jew, they'll never accept her as queen, or they'll never let her practice her Judaism, as Ibn Ezra put it. So we had two different schools of thought about how Jews were perceived in the beginning. Either way, when you get to chapter 4, and Haman has issued his decree that all the Jews are going to get killed, so at that point, we are clearly targets. Everybody's ready to attack us, right? That message is straightforward. So, now let's look at chapter 6. Because in chapter 6, what Ahasuerus broadcasts to the people of Shushan is that Jews are the ones Ahasuerus wants to honor. That may be part of what drives Zeresh's changed reaction. Right? Whether she thinks it's because God did it, or whether she just sees it as human events, fundamentally, the Jews now are no longer vulnerable. Right? Because the king wants to honor them. Which explains something that happens in chapter 8. In chapter 8, right, we actually get to the move to cancel the king's decree. But is Esther successful in canceling the king's decree against the Jews? We know the story. No. The decree is still out there. The 13th day of Adar is supposed to be a day when the forces of 127 lands are going to attack the Jews. So tell me something. How do the Jews successfully defend themselves? Granted that now, by royal order, the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. Shkoach, you're not the majority in any of those 127 lands. How did you survive that? Answer? Because of what happened in our chapter. Because you may be allowed to attack them, but they're the ones the king wants to honor. And that causes people to fall back. That's why they don't attack in chapter 8. That's what enables the Jews to survive. So what happens in this chapter here changes popular perception of Jews. You follow? I think that's very important. I think it really does deserve more conversation at some point, especially because it's bigger than the Esther story. This is always the hope of the Jew in exile, right? It's Yosef, it's Daniel, it's the court Jew philosophy, which we've talked about before. If I can reach the point where the king publicly declares support for a Jew, maybe Jews on the whole will be better off. You follow? How many times does it happen that you hear somebody got an honor, somebody got some special status, right? And immediately you get emails from people, hey, that person is Jewish. There's a sense of protection that comes with the fact that somebody who made good is a Jew. And we're not the only ethnicity to think that way. I think it's normally the way minorities think. But I think it really comes through in the role that this story plays in the book. Okay.